So it's a pleasure to have Itai here from Tel Aviv. He will be telling us about comagnetometers as a probe of new physics. Thanks, Itai.
So thank you very much for inviting me. Don't worry, I will be explaining what are comagnetometers for most of the talk probably. This is a work, like I mentioned, I'm doing in Tel Aviv University with my advisor, Tomer Volansky. And also the paper that is the main subject of this talk was done with Yonit Ochberg and Eric Kuflick from Hebrew University. And there's new information, like I said, literally from the last few weeks. Even there's something here that's not even updated for the previous, from 2 days ago. This is that I'm going to be updating on that hasn't appeared in the paper, but I will be discussing, and this is done in collaboration with Gil Ronen and Or Katz. So, first of all, the outline of the talk. We will start by just a very brief reminder of what are axions and axion-like particles. Hopefully, we won't need to spend too much time on that. Then I will be focusing a bit on what are coherent interactions in the context that I care about, which is how I'm going to look for these axions. And then most of the talk will be discussing what is a comagnetometer, as well as how the dynamics of this device look like, what are some of the experiments you can perform with it, as well as the future prospects, as well as, like I said, some recent developments. Hopefully, we will also have time for conclusions. So, axion-like particles, as you probably know, it all started out at the 77 roughly, when Roberto Peccei, who recently passed, and Helen Quinn offered a new solution to the strong CP problem. And a year later, Weinberg and Wilczek found out that they actually introduced a new particle, the axion. And basically, the way to easily think of this, it doesn't really matter for us, but that you had theta QCD, the vacuum angle, which we never were never able to measure. And by effectively promoting it to a field, you find out that you do not expect it to measure because the depth of that field takes care of that. I mean, that's very broadly it. The axions are pseudoscalars, and they have derivative couplings, generically something like that, where you can add another order one parameter here to multiply this thing, the derivative of the axion field times this coupling to some fermion, and the coupling to the standard model goes like 1 over FA, where FA is what we call the decay constant of the axion. Basically, the bigger this thing is, the weaker the interaction with standard model particles is as well. Now, because of the way to solve the strong CP problem, you can find out some relationship between the mass of the axion, which is produced by non-perturbative effects, and this 1 over FA. So that means that the lighter MA is, the weaker the interaction is with the standard model. They can be a cold dogmatic component, i.e., they can be produced in the early universe in the right abundances, and they can be stable to this day, and they have very weak interactions. And they can be extremely light, much lighter than we're used to when discussing WIMPs, and still remain a valid cold dogmatic component. Specifically, I will be discussing ultralight axion-like particles, which are lighter than 10 to the minus 12 eV in my definition. Of course, ultralight is a subjective definition. Axion-like particles, as you probably know, are no longer a solution to the strong CP problem. They can arise from other things. We don't really care about what, but the main important part is that they no longer have this relationship between the mass and the decay constant. And the reason this is important is because, like I said, I'm looking for very light axions. So if this was a QCD axion, this relationship tells me that they will also be interacting very weakly with the standard model. So I would not be able to detect them. So that's why I cannot look for really QCD axions. Moreover, throughout the talk, I will be assuming that if the axion-like particles are dark matter, and I will be calling them axions, you know, without worrying too much about ALPS versus axions. If they are dark matter, they're going to be all of it. You can easily translate any statement I make if they are only 5% or your favorite other fraction of all dark matter. So the interactions of axion-like particles and the standard model are usually divided into three main types of interactions. We have the Primakov effect, which is what I think most people are looking for, the interaction of A with FF dual under a magnetic field, an axion and an electric field can mix. Then we have the interaction of axions with gluons, sort of the original sin related to how they really solve the strong CP problem. Some people are looking for that, as we discussed in lunch. Some people here perhaps even are trying to look for this. And the thing I will be focusing on is this interaction, the interaction of axions and fermions. And this sort of looks like the absorption of a photon, okay? The terms are very similar. And to be even more specific, the two fermions I'm going to be looking at are neutrons and electrons. And I'm going to be pushing this because it's a bit hiding. Is there a way to hide this? Never mind. So neutrons and electrons. So what I'm showing you here is the parameter space of neutrons and the parameter space of electrons. On the y-axis are the couplings, okay, for neutrons, electrons, and on the x-axis are masses. And what you're seeing in black, the darker shades, are terrestrial experiments, specifically the CASPER experiment. They have two different experimental apparatuses, NUN/NUAG, some other experiment. I don't think they have an official, some nice name. Some bounds from meson decays and some bounds from long range interactions. And in green, what we're seeing here are the bounds from astrophysics. And as you can see, the bounds from terrestrial experiments, and by terrestrial, I mean experiments where you have a room and inside that room is your experimental apparatus. Basically, that's my very simplified definition. And they are way behind the experiments from astrophysics. Specifically, this is the bound from the cooling of supernova 1987A. And this is the bound from the cooling of, the introduction of a new cooling channel to some neutron star they recently found, okay? And it's roughly five orders of magnitude or four orders of magnitude better than the terrestrial experiments. And the same goes for the interactions of axions and electrons. These are also two other terrestrial experiments. And the question is, can we actually improve on these astrophysical bounds? And I think there are two important reasons why we would want to do that. The first reason is that these bounds come with a lot of uncertainties, right? Sometimes when you look far away and you look at a neutron star, maybe it's not really your typical neutron star. Maybe it's not exactly what you think it is. Maybe some of the measurements are being, maybe some of the things you think you know about neutron star is not exact, right? Because it requires a lot of complicated QCD computations. So there's a lot of uncertainties and, you know, these papers admit it as well, right? The bounds usually should not be taken as a very rough line, right? I mean, it's sort of just, it's just a rough approximation of what is the actual bound. And the second reason is that people recently have started to look at, or maybe it's recently is not true, people have been looking in it for a while, for stuff that's chameleonized models. Basically models where in a high density region, the axions might not get produced, okay? And therefore you might not get these stellar bounds. And it might be worthwhile to try to get an experiment where the density is lower, you have more control over what you're looking at. And that's why I think it's important to try and compete with these bounds. And the reason why these bounds are so strong, by the way, is because, you know, even a tiny axion has a huge effect on a giant neutron star if you wait for long enough, right? It can change exactly its temperature. It can change many things because their experimental apparatus is basically so huge. While terrestrial experiments usually have something like this or something, right, depending on the exact experiment. So it's very hard to compete. And there is a way which you can try to compete, and that is by sort of using something called coherent interactions, okay? So to understand what are coherent interactions, you need to remember that when you're producing a particle, let's say in a star or something, then all the effects you're looking at will always go like the coupling squared, right? Because it's some matrix element that goes like the coupling, you need to take that matrix element squared, and therefore you're going like something that is very small squared. And coherent interactions are usually, well, it's a very broad definition, but are usually things that do not need to take the matrix element square. So you might be linearly sensitive to the very small coupling constants that we're trying to, that you want to look for. So what I'm showing you here is the number density of axions. 0.3 GeV per centimeter cube is the energy density of dark matter. I divided by the mass to get the number of axions per unit volume. And you can plug in for very light axion-like particles. I remind you, I'm looking at 13 orders of magnitude lighter than that. And what you see is the amount of axions per unit volume, okay? Basically, if I think of an axion as something the size of a de Broglie wavelength, the amount of axions per the unit volume of a single axion is gonna be much larger than one, okay? This is this means that you can no longer think of these as tiny dots that are floating around in space, hitting each other and hitting the world. Okay, the much better approximation would be as a plane wave. Just like when you look at the lamp, you don't think of the photons as if they were arriving, you know, one by one. We think of it as a giant plane wave. Okay, so this is a much better approximation. And under that approximation, we can try to take the non-relativistic limit for the interactions of axions and the fermion. And I will save you, I will save you the computation. Okay, and what you end up getting is this sort of interaction. Okay, you get this Hamiltonian, you can develop the Lagrangian, which couples directly to the spin of a particle of each of a fermion to which the axion is coupling to. These are just two different ways to write it, right? I can put inside this BA, GA, psi, psi, and I can write it as BA, psi, right? These are just two different ways to write it. And what we're getting here is that the spin of a fermion is affected by what we call the anomalous axion field. Okay, if the anomalous axion field, which is what I'm showing you here, and I will be describing term by term in a second, if it's pointing in the same direction as a spin, I'm going to get one contribution to the energy, okay? And if it's pointing the other way, I'm going to get minus that energy. Okay, these are two energy states pointing aligned or anti-aligned with the spin of the particle. What is this field? It's linear in the coupling, okay? Then we have square root of the energy density. This is something that you can see a lot in coherent interactions because usually they go like some amplitude and densities go like amplitude squared. So this is why you see your square root. It oscillates according to the mass. So basically what I'm going to be looking for is something that oscillates according to the mass of the axion. If the axion has a 1/2 second mass, right, in natural units, I'm going to be looking for a field that every 1 second flips its direction. And the direction of this field is the relative velocity of the axion fermion, of the axion and fermion. So this is what I will be trying to look for. And this is, like I said, linear in this coupling, which is exactly what I wanted to. I wanted to find some effect which is linear in the coupling because it's a very small number. Astrophysics go like this number squared. So if I can find something linear, I might be able to compute. So of course, the question is, can we actually measure this thing, right? Because I can also write this thing, the square root of this field, and that would go like the square root of the coupling, which is so very nice. But if I cannot measure it, it doesn't mean anything. So to understand how we can measure it, I need to give you sort of a reminder from quantum physics of what is Larmor precession and Zeeman splitting, which are two aspects of the same effect, basically. So if you have some magnetic field and you have some spin s, then the spin would want to rotate around the magnetic field. Okay, this is what you're seeing here. It's a torque term where the spin would want to rotate around this magnetic field. This gamma here is called the gyromagnetic ratio. Every particle has its own gyromagnetic ratio. It is related to how the particle interacts with photons, and it's a basic property of the particle. The electrons have one, protons have one, the neutrons have one, and so on. Any particle with a spin should have its own gyromagnetic ratio. If you write this term in terms of the Hamiltonian, you find out what we call Zeeman splitting, where if a spin is aligned or anti-aligned with a magnetic field, you get one contribution to the energy or the opposite of it. And hopefully you haven't forgotten because it was just the previous slide. This was what I was trying to look for. And as you can see, these two things look exactly the same. Okay, the only difference is that here I call it BA psi, and here I call it gamma B, right? So if I can look for this effect, I will also be able to look for this because they couple to matter exactly the same way. And now you might want to ask yourself, have humans found a way to measure magnetic fields? Well, of course, the answer is yes. People cared about magnetic fields long before they cared about axions. And specifically, you can try to use something called an alkali magnetometer to look for this exact effect. And it is indeed sensitive to this exact effect in a linear way, which is exactly what I wanted. However, it is also measuring actual magnetic field, right? Because the magnetic fields look exactly like this new anomalous effect, I'm going to be measuring, if I try to measure the new effect, I'm also going to be measuring regular magnetic fields. And no matter how clean your lab is, okay, you can try to put some shielding and whatever, in the end, thermal magnetic noise is going to be way, way stronger than the tiny effect of the axion. So while this...
Excuse me, may I interrupt you? So you yes. say that this is exactly the same interaction. Well, for magnetic fields, I can imagine that you measure it with some... microscopic devices where this S is actually the spin of the big device, yeah, like the total magnetic, the total angular momentum of a macroscopic object, yeah. Whereas axions, they couple specifically to the spins of elementary particles, yeah. So I think there is a difference here, right? So this S in the first formula is probably not S but J.
No, the interaction of there is a spin magnetic coupling. I mean, that's the Zeeman splitting is couples directly to, oh, you're saying that this is the total spin?
Yeah, sure. If your device is really like measuring magnetic field using spins of atoms or elementary particles, I will agree with you, but yeah, you're just saying that any device that measures magnetic field should be suitable. This I think is not quite correct. Yeah? Yes, so some of them use a macroscopic momentum. Yeah.
Yes, you cannot look for this using Lorentz force. That's true. I mean, Lorentz force so this... V plus F does not exist for us. And with that,
yeah, essentially, that's what I mean. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, you are right. I was not being accurate. The meaning was that any effect that is sensitive to this device, to this thing, will be sensitive to that. You're right. That was not accurate.
Okay.
And indeed, alkali magnetometers measure this exact effect. They don't measure the Lorentz force. They measure the coupling to spins. So magnetometers, sorry. So the question is, if I can measure both of them, I cannot tell the difference, I am in a problem, right? Because the magnetic noise is very, very big. And the question is, can I actually somehow differentiate the new effect from the old effect? And if I just try to look at the spin of, let's say, an electron, I would not be able to do that. But if I measure two different particles, because they each come with some coupling that is related to the interaction of, let's say, an electron and an axion, or an electron and a photon, if I look at two different particles, say electrons and neutrons, suddenly there is no relationship between how an photon couples to neutrons and electron and how an axion couples to neutrons and electron, right? These are two different interactions and the coupling constant would not be proportional to each other. So if I measure once the coupling to an electron spin and the second time I measure the coupling to a neutron spin, in that case, I can suddenly basically diagonalize my matrix. I'm measuring two variables, I'm measuring two linear combinations of two variables. So I can diagonalize my matrix. I can subtract the two numbers, however you want to call it. And I can differentiate the new effect of the axions from the older one of the magnetic field. And this is basically how things work, but it is not enough. The reason is that if you just measure these two numbers independently, it's very hard to subtract the two numbers, usually because you have some different systematics in each of them. So you get some effects that are not exactly canceling. So that's why it doesn't work that way. And one of the best bounds in the graph I showed you earlier actually comes from doing exactly that. They measured the coupling to two different types of atom, and they took the difference, and that's how they looked for axion. And the question is, what if we build some device where you subtract the splitting, sorry, where the device subtracts the splitting on its own? It's not that I'm measuring two numbers and then I'm using my computer and taking the difference. The device physically only outputs a single number, and that is the number that I care about, okay? And indeed, as you can probably guess, that is exactly a common magnetometer, because otherwise I would not be asking that question. So in case you fell asleep, all I was saying basically until now was that axion-like particle dark matter can generate something that exactly looks like a magnetic field, unless you try to differentiate by looking at two particles. And as Sergey mentioned, you can also maybe look for Lorentz force and maybe compare that to coupling to spin or something. But if you look just as couplings to spin, then basically the only way that you can differentiate an axion and a regular magnetic field is by measuring two different particles. And that's exactly what a co-magnetometer is going to do. So let's discuss what is a co-magnetometer. So first, I'm going to sort of show you what you should think about when you think of as a co-magnetometer. It's not an actual physically possible thing. Okay, that will be the next slide. But first, I'm going to show you sort of what is behind why this thing works the way it does. So what you should think about is if you have free electrons and free neutrons in a cell. Okay, like I said, it's of course not going to be actual free electrons, but that's sort of the thing that stands behind why this thing works. And free electrons and neutrons that are floating in some
excuse
cell.
Me, before you go on, may I ask you again? Well, another thing. So for electrons, we know how they couple to magnetic field. Yeah, we know this gamma E, very precisely from calculations, yes, theoretically.
Yes.
So then what if I measure something like interaction with orbital momentum where axion does not participate, maybe using some energy level splitting or something, extract magnetic field from there, and then subtracted from the correction due to spin.
So the problem is that despite the fact that we do know gamma E very accurately, in the end, the effect of an axion that you're describing would go like G squared, right? Because it is an exchange. It's sort of how you affect the actual coupling of axions to photons specifically, right? This gamma, how it couples to photon, will only be changed by some loop correction or some effect where the axion is no longer a coherent effect. What I'm going to be looking for is an external axion. It's not the fundamental.
Yeah, yeah. No, I probably didn't express it well. No, I'm not talking about loop corrections. I'm just saying that magnetic field. So basically, what is the problem? The problem is to know magnetic field, right? Precisely. So why we cannot measure this magnetic field from its coupling to the orbital momentum? And then looking at the effects due to spin, spin splitting or something, like level splitting due to spin, just subtract, multiply this known magnetic field by known gamma E and subtract.
So the answer is I don't actually know whether they're so usually I think electrons do not come with an orbital momentum, right? They only come with the total, usually you couple directly to, that might actually, so in the end, I won't be going into it because it sort of a bit more intrigued, but what you do couple to in the end, there's an F, right? The hyperfine levels that are defined mm-hmm. by F, and that's the spin of the electron. And usually the spin of the electron is the thing that is important. And it's very hard, I think, to measure both the coupling to an orbital momentum and the coupling to S independently. I don't know how you could do that, but there might be something there. I simply am not aware of such a thing that you could do, because usually you end up measuring some combination of the total angular momentum of the atom. So it's very hard, I think, to measure two numbers independently from the same atom.
Yeah, I agree with you that you measure probably something, some combination, but probably different combinations depending on the alignment or anti-alignment of the orbital momentum and spin, something like this. I mean, just depending on the total angular momentum, you get different levels. So I was wondering if by studying the level splittings, the energy level splittings between these different levels with different total J, you can do something.
Maybe, I don't want to, I'm not sure. You might, I mean, I just don't know. The answer is I think so. You probably can do something. I don't know how accurate that would be, but it sounds like you might be able to do something. I'm not familiar with anyone who's doing that.
It's not something you are doing,
yes.
You are suggesting.
Yes,
okay,
I'm
you're
not
suggesting something else. Okay, good. Thanks.
So I have these electrons and neutrons in the cell. And basically, I'm introducing something that I will call a pump, okay? And what this pump does is it pumps electrons, okay? Basically, it gives the system some direction, some preferred spin direction, because if you just put electron inside some cell, they're all going to be pointing in random spin direction. So you need something to tell them where you want them to point if you want to have a macroscopic spin, okay? Which is what we want, because otherwise it's very hard to measure the coupling to spin. Next, the neutrons themselves actually do not interact with the pump, okay? It's related to how exactly we implement it. But the electrons collide with the neutrons and give them some of their own spin. So now I have electrons that are polarized by the pump and neutrons that are polarized by the electrons. So both of these particles now have a preferred spin direction. I also have a camera. That camera is only able to measure actually the electrons. So if I think of these as sort of two independent measurements, then I can only measure whatever couples to electrons, so I will not be able to measure the coupling of axions to neutrons. Now, this is sort of where the magic happens, because I can apply some magnetic field that transform these two independent particles from being independent with each other to interacting with each other, and I'm introducing something that we call the resonance regime. And if I tune my magnetic field just right, I can do exactly what I want, which is to get an immunity to the regular magnetic field while remaining sensitive to the new anomalous field. Now, exactly how this works will be the remainder of this talk, but now let's try to look at how things actually look like. So if you want to build your own co-magnetometer, you need to go to the store and buy these things. First of all, the cell is indeed a cell. It's a 1-inch diameter glass cell. Of course, you can have different sizes of the cell depending on the exact experiment you want to run, but this is sort of the typical size. Then instead of electron, what we actually have is potassium vapor. Now, potassium is an alkali metal, okay? And that means that it has a single electron in the outermost shell. So all the other electrons are pointing in opposite spin direction, and the entire spin of the particle is determined by the electron. There is actually a correction related to the hyperfine levels. It is a bit beyond, I don't think it's exactly what Sergey was discussing. I mean, we cannot measure these two things independently, but it might be, someone might be able to use this actually, maybe if you try to use different isotopes, sort of they have different nuclear spin, and then it's a bit of a different of complete spin moment, sorry, a bit of a different angular momentum, but I'm not sure. But basically, if you, to simplify things, these alkali atoms are actually just the outermost electron for the purposes of spin. Now, we also have helium-free gas. This is a logarithmic plot, which means that I have 7 more helium-3 atoms. So I have 10 to the 7 helium atoms for each potassium atom. So there's a lot more of these helium-3 atoms. Helium-3 in its nucleus has 2 protons pointing in opposite spin directions and a single neutron, which determines the spin of this particle. So this is why I have neutrons and electrons. Now, my pump and probe are actually lasers with energies that are related to the energy level of the potassium atom, which is why the helium does not feel them, okay? And this is not very important, but the probe is basically not affecting the actual system. It's something called non-demolition measurements. And it's not really important for the purposes of the talk, but the way to think about it is that it's sort of an outside observer that can measure the projection of the alkali spin on this axis. We usually call the direction of the macroscopic spin the Z, and the direction of the probe is going to be the X. Now, if you want to build your own quantum magnetometer, you're actually going to need a bunch of other stuff, such as an oven, because this is actually potassium vapor and not potassium gas, which means it comes from some droplet that you heat, and then there's a bit of vapor that you can measure. There's also magnetic shields that are protecting you from Earth's magnetic field, because even if we can take the difference between two numbers, Earth's magnetic field is such a huge magnetic field that it's a lot easier to first, you know, kill it to some extent and then try to make your measurement. We also have magnetic coils that allow us to make controlled magnetic field, unlike the magnetic noise. This is something that we can completely control. And we also have a bunch of optical components, you know, that are important to use your laser beam correctly with the right polarization and so on. So that's why you need some optical components around this, which are not really important for the talk. So
can I ask you a small question about the potassium? So the nuclear spin is negligible because you check that you don't have other isotopes, and so you only have those with an even number of nucleons.
So the reason why it's negligible is because the coupling of photons to nucleons is much smaller than the coupling of photons to electrons. I mean, for the gyromagnetic ratio, of course, they both, I mean, not charge-wise, but from the point of view of the gyromagnetic ratio, which is why they affect very weakly this B dot S interaction. They do affect it. We do take that into account in our calculations. But when you carry out the full math of the quantum magnetometer, you can see that basically you can use this sort of, but it is like a 0.1% correction to the total effect. So the effect that we are looking for, we're going to tune some things such that this effect is going to be negligible, but you can sort of also only measure interactions of axions and neutrons by measuring just the alkali because it does have some nuclear spin.
Instead, for the helium-3, it has a vanishing spin for the electron shell. Yes. And there you choose the helium-3 instead of helium-4 in order to have this nuclear spin. And you have many more of those, right? So
yes, we have a lot of them, yes.
Okay, thanks.
Great. So first magnetometer, now let's discuss how the magnetometer the alkali magnetometer dynamics looks like. So at T equals zero, when I just start my experiment, I'm putting the alkali metal inside my cell and they're not gonna do anything. But then I turn on my laser and roughly after 1/50th of a second, the laser is going to pump the alkali atoms to have a macroscopic polarization. And we also have something called relaxation, which comes both from the laser as well as collisions with the walls and other atoms that's gonna relax the system. So basically this term, the pumping term, comes from the laser. SPU is the spin of the laser, which is pointing in the Z direction. And if I went 1/50th of a second, I'm gonna get some polarization in the Z direction. And I'm also have this relaxation, this relaxation term. And basically if I move my initial conditions from the steady state solution, then it's gonna take 1/50th of a second for the system to relax back to where it was pointing towards the Z direction. Okay, so this is before I turn on my magnetic fields. This is just basically if I have the alkali and I have some laser and the alkali is gonna get some spin from the laser and then it's gonna reach some steady state. Now let's see what happens when I introduce magnetic fields. Basically after the system has relaxed, reached some equilibrium, I can start to look for the effect of both old magnetic fields as well as new ones, the anomalous fields. And this terms look like some torque. And what it's gonna do is it's basically going to tilt the direction of the spin. Okay, and if the magnetic fields or the anomalous fields change as a function of time, then the alkali is going to change its direction also as a function of time. It's always going to feel some torque from these fields, and then that's why it's not going to be pointing at the Z direction. It's going to have some correction which is related to these fields. Okay, so instead of just having a system where everything is pointing in the Z direction, some of the alkali is going to start to tilt and point in a direction which is linear, in the magnetic and new anomalous field. So now let's see what happens at the steady state. And I'm going to be only discussing leading order and important stuff. What do I call the steady state? Steady state for me is when I can plug in S dot equals zero. The spin in the Z direction is completely determined by the pump and the relaxation rate. Okay, it is, has no sensitivity to the magnetic field as long as they are weak enough. Okay, as long as they are weak enough, they appear in second order terms. So that's why I have no reason to measure the z direction. It has no sensitivity to what I care about. On the other hand, the transverse direction, as you can see, because it's actually a torque term that's a bit reverse. So if I have a spin in the y direction, it's going to affect the spin in the x direction. Sorry, if I have a magnetic field in the y direction, it's going to affect the spin in the x direction. Magnetic field in the x direction going to affect the spin in the y direction. And the important part is that it is indeed linear in the new anomalous field. So this is something I can directly measure, and it is linear in the anomalous field, which is linear in the coupling, which is why I'm very happy, because I found what I wanted. But as I warned you before, it is also linear in the regular magnetic field. Moreover, the gyromagnetic ratio of the alkali metals is a very big number. So if I just try to measure this thing, not only am I sensitive to noise, I am very, very sensitive to my magnetic noise, because this number is very, very big. So one way to try to reduce our magnetic noise is to try to find an atom with a smaller gyromagnetic ratio. Specifically, noble gases, which are helium-3, xenon-129, xenon-131, and neon-21. I think these are the noble gases that have nuclear spin. Maybe argon has one as well, but I don't know anyone that uses it. And as a bonus, they have almost no chemical interaction. This is why I can cram a lot of them in my cell. Basically, I put as many, for the case of helium-3, which is the noblest of noble gases, right? It has very, very weak interaction. The xenon atoms actually do have some interaction, which is why if you try to put too many of them, they start to form molecules, for virtual molecules for fractions of a moment, and then they destroy everything. But helium is very noble. It doesn't interact chemically with anything. So you can cram it inside your cell literally until it blows up from the pressure. That's what stops us from putting more helium-3 gas. And this is very useful, because if you think of each particle as a single measurement, having many, many particles is going to give you a better, quieter measurement. Okay, so this is basically why we want to have a lot of helium atoms. And unlike the alkali metal, which is very chemically reactive, helium and to some extent xenon and neon are much weaker chemically interacting, and so you can put a lot of them in your cell. So let's now discuss how would the noble magnetometer look like. And I should say this is actually a naive noble magnetometer. People do use noble magnetometer in a way that's smarter than what I'm going to present to you. But pedagogically, it's going to be very much more relevant to describe what I am going to describe. So at t equals zero, I'm just going to have helium-3 atoms in my cell, very pretty, very nice, but they don't do anything. Then I wait roughly 1 hour, usually even several hours. And unlike previously, where the laser was pumping the alkali, now collisions with the alkali metal are going to pump the helium-3 atoms. So after several hours, the helium-3 atoms are going to get some spin direction, and just like the alkali. And also, they also have their own relaxation rate related to hitting the walls. But because of how weak their chemical reactions are, even when they hit the wall, they can usually keep their own spin, which is why the relaxation rate is also several hours. Now, if I wait this enough time for this system to stabilize, I can also, just like earlier, try to look for the new anomalous as well as regular magnetic field. And the helium-3 spin are also, just like the alkali, going to follow whichever magnetic field I have. However, unlike the alkali, if the magnetic field is changing too fast, because the helium have a very slow reaction time, they are not going to be able to follow, okay? So my ability to react to magnetic fields is determined by the relaxation rate. So now I can only follow with the helium magnetic fields that oscillate slower than roughly 1/1 hour. And I remind you, my mass was my oscillation rate. So that means that I'm now limited, and I can only look for much, much lighter axons than I was able to look for earlier. And indeed, just like earlier, I'm going to get that the steady state is going to be tilting according to the magnetic fields. But like I said, only the fields change slow enough. So the steady state, just like earlier, looks basically the same thing, a bit different, but we are still linear in the new field. And indeed, we are able to reduce the magnetic noise by roughly 100 or 1,000, because the gyromagnetic ratio of helium is, I don't remember the exact number, but roughly 100 or 1,000 times smaller than that of the alkali. However, the magnetic noise is still way too big. The effect I'm looking for is much, much weaker than even this suppression gave me. And because, like I said, the masses I'm looking for are also the acceleration of the field, the slow reaction time means I can only measure much, much lighter masses than I can with the alkali. So what might save us? What can we do? What we can do is to try to combine these two independent magnetometers to what we call the co-magnetometer. So the effect that I neglected to mention was something called the mutually induced magnetic field. Basically, when the potassium and helium hit each other, the alkali pumps the helium. But another effect is that they apply a magnetic field on each other that is proportional to the direction of the spin. So they go closer, and they each want to rotate around the other. This happens very rapidly, so you end up getting some mean effect. Okay, it's not like huge magnetic field and then nothing. You get some mean magnetic field that each applies on the other one. These come from quantum point-like interaction. This is not actually the long-range dipole-dipole magnetic field that you might be used to. That one actually zeroes out in a spherical cell. And what you end up getting regardless is that the induced magnetic field on the potassium by the helium is proportional to the spin of the helium. The induced magnetic field on the helium by the potassium is proportional to the spin of the potassium. Okay? So each of them applies an average magnetic field on the other guy. And because I don't actually have a lot of time, I'm going to save you the trouble of seeing some math field slides, because the next slide is actually a bit mathy. What I'm basically showing there is just how we can sort of rewrite things in a, just for the transfer state. It's a bit easier to, instead of having x hat and y hat, I'm going to move to x plus I for the y direction. And the reason why this is useful is that cross terms are going to look just like multiplying the two vectors and adding an I in front of it. It's just an easier notation. And the equations that I have, okay, that if I ignore the new the induced magnetic field that each of these guys induces on the other guy, then basically I have one term that comes from the Z magnetic field on the alkali. The alkali is going to rotate around the Z magnetic field, as well as the relaxation rate for the alkali. And I can neglect the relaxation rate of the helium because it's so tiny. And I also have this rotation of the helium field around the magnetic field. Okay, so this is basically the equations. And once I introduce the new magnetic field that each of these guys applies on the other, this introduces two effects. The first one is that it creates a mixing between the transfer states. Basically, if my helium is pointing in the X direction, my alkali is now going to want to point in the Y direction because it wants to rotate around the helium. Okay, so this means that my two independent equations of motions for the helium and the potassium are no longer independent. Each of these guys wants to rotate the other guy. The other thing that this does is because I have a lot of spins pointing in the Z direction, the helium atoms are, feeling the magnetic field of the alkali, and the alkali atoms are feeling the magnetic fields of the helium atoms in the Z direction. So even if I apply no magnetic field on my own, each is still going to feel some magnetic field in the Z direction. Okay.
There's something that I don't understand. So are you at this? So when this is all happening, are you also shining these pins with light to continuously measure them, like in your quantum condemnation experiment?
Yes.
So why isn't there then in this equation also a third term, a third element in the vector, which is the polarization of the photon? Because in the end, what you measure, it's probably not spin. You are shining light into this thing, and in the end, what you get is some sort of like spin polariton, right? And you measure out the polariton that goes out. And the action also couples to photons.
Yes. The action couples to photons, you said?
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's an important effect, but I mean, in my naive understanding, there's three elements and they all mix. It's the spin of these two guys and the polarization of the laser that you're shooting in to measure these things, right? And the eigenstate that you measure out, it's some combination of the three, right?
You are right. However, the coupling, because usually when you try to do experiments like light shining through a wall, you need to apply a huge magnetic field in order to measure the mixing between the axions and the photon. But because we apply a pretty small magnetic field, and usually they also have a lot of repetitions, it goes like back and forth in some cavity or something similar, but we don't have that. So you are right, the axions couple to the lasers, but it's sort of a very, very small effect compared to what we are measuring. You are right, but it is much, much smaller. But you're right. just because the magnetic field, I mean, for the Primakov effect, you need an electric field, which in this case would be the laser, as well as some magnetic field. And our magnetic field is much, much smaller than what these people use usually.
But also your laser, I guess your laser is polarized, is it?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so that polarization, how is it achieved? I guess it's achieved by a resonance or something, some resonant kite or something that itself.
No, we use linear polarizers. Just I don't actually remember how they work. I think it's some form of I don't remember how linear polarizers.
Okay, it's just like some sort of like screen or something that
that
we put in between.
Yeah, before everything. And then I have some wave plates that give me the right polarization I want.
Okay, and how big are the magnetic fields that you're applying here?
Milligausses. So I think these people usually look at Teslas, which are
right,
like 7 orders of magnitude above what I'm looking at.
Okay, so you're saying that this, if it's milligausses, it's tiny, but I guess you have checked that also the axon doesn't affect somehow your measuring device.
I agree that in theory you're right. I think practically it's very small, but you're right. I mean, it is something worth looking, but I doubt that it's an important effect, just because otherwise you wouldn't need light shining for a wall to work so hard to get these huge magnetic fields. But you might be right. I mean, it is worth looking into.
No, this is very small. It won't affect your
scale.
For example, exactly for the reason that you said, the B field that you have.
Yeah, it's tiny.
So it's tiny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it's so small and it. Yeah. No.
Yeah. So these are my equations, and even if you don't want to look too much into them because they are not very pretty equations, I like them, but you know, a matter of taste. What is interesting to notice is that it's an ordinary differential equation, so it has two modes and two eigenvalues. And if you've taken analytical mechanics recently, you might want to ask yourself, can we do a resonant coupling of these two modes? I can control one of the parameters of this system. I can control the magnetic field in the Z direction that I apply, and I can basically tune the eigenvalues of each of these guys in a not independent way, in a way which affects both of them differently. And the question is, can I do some sort of resonant coupling? Okay, and what would that actually mean? Okay, so to understand that, we first need to do some control group, basically, right? Just like in corona experiment, you need to look at what happens without resonance before you can discuss what happens when you have resonance, right? So first of all, let's look what happens before I even introduce the mixing. I just have a magnetometer of electrons. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull it from its steady state. I'm going to magically, pull one of the spins a bit, and then I'm going to see what happens to the system. So because the alkali has a giant relaxation rate and has a very large gyro magnetic ratio, it's going to rotate around like crazy in a spiral. And very soon after 1/50th of a second, okay, it's going to go back to where it was pointing. So even if I change the initial conditions, the system is going to relax very fast and it's going to rotate like hell. If I do the same thing for a helium atom, then because the gyro magnetic ratio is much smaller, it's just going to keep on rotating for a very, very long time. And also because the gyro magnetic ratio is small, this is going to be a very slow rotation. And because the relaxation rate is small, it's going to take several hours before I'm going to be able to notice a decay of this amplitude. So this is the difference between these two guys. Now let's see what happens if I introduce a mixing between these two magnetometers, but I'm not at the resonance yet. So if I do the same thing for the alkali as I was doing before, then basically at the beginning, the alkali is going to do its crazy thing. It's going to rotate like hell. But then because the alkali was shifted from its initial position, it rotated the helium a bit. So now the helium is rotating. And because after the fast mode has decayed, the alkali is, the helium is still going to rotate, I'm going to be able to see that the alkali is still rotating around the helium atom. Okay, so after the crazy thing happened, the system is going to keep on being affected, but it's a very small effect because I'm far from the resonance. For the helium, what happens is when I pull the helium from the steady state, the alkali is going to go crazy. Okay, it's going to rotate because I changed the total magnetic field. But basically, after a while, the alkali is going to relax. It's going to reach some steady state where it rotates around this helium atom. And therefore, once you wait enough time, you're not going to see anything different compared to before. These two things would look exactly the same. At the beginning, the fast mode is going to go crazy a bit, but then things are going to relax. Now let's see what happens at the actual resonance. This is coming from the 2002 paper by Cornack and Ramalis, which was sort of the first paper for common magnetometers of this type. And there they show basically how things look like at the resonance very nicely. So what we're seeing here is the spin of the alkali in arbitrary units. And first of all, we're 25% away from the resonance, and I'm changing the initial direction of the alkali. And basically here, you cannot see because of the resolution, the alkali goes like crazy. But after a while, we only see the slow mode of the helium, which mixes with the alkali. Now let's see what happens when I move 5% away from the resonance. In this case, the two eigenmodes are much closer than what they were. Okay, the mixing is also stronger, which is why the amplitudes are much bigger compared to when I was far away from the resonance. Okay, so basically we're seeing two things at the same time. First, the eigenmodes are much closer. The alkali has a much longer period of time, as well as the helium starts to decay. Right? Earlier, I was not able to discern whether this thing started to decay, but now I can actually see that the amplitude of the slow mode has a finite lifetime. Okay? And the second thing is that the mixing is stronger, so when I tilt one of these guys, the other guy is going to tilt as well. And when I'm at the actual resonance, there is a single eigenmode to the system. So basically, there is no longer a mode that takes hours to relax. Both modes in less than 1 second can go back to their steady state. And instead of having two independent measurements, I now have a single hybrid measurement of these two different modes, okay? It does one flop around, and then basically the two atoms relax back to where they were. So this is very nice because this means that I can use the helium atoms to measure an axion of a mass that is much higher than I was able before. Because earlier I was only able to measure masses that were roughly smaller than 1/1 hour, but now I can go back to measuring masses that are smaller than 1/50th of a second. This is coming from our lab. I'm not gonna go into it, but it's basically just showing that the decay rate of the slow mode stops being that slow, once you reach the resonance. So now let's discuss the compensation point, which is sort of the thing that I was promising, because while the resonance is nice, it still does not tell you that you only measure the linear combination that you care about. But that is exactly what the compensation point does. And by luck, not really luck, by math more, the compensation point happens very near the resonance regime. It is not like the actual peak of it, okay? It's not like they are as mixed as possible, but it's very close to that point. And at the compensation point, every regular magnetic field that the alkali should be feeling is immediately compensated by the nuclear spin. And that means that you have no sensitivity to regular magnetic fields. And that's very hard to say with words. So now let's try and look at an illustration. So I should mention, I am not an arts major. So, and these are 3D sizes. So take this with some caution, right? It's not going to be a mathematical description, but it does, I think, pass on the main point. Let's say I have some magnetic noise. I have the alkali and I have the helium. Both of these guys are going to tilt around because of that magnetic noise. However, the total magnetic field that the alkali is feeling is the sum of the induced magnetic field by the helium, as well as the magnetic noise. And I can tune the response of the helium basically, such that these two things always cancel. This is a linear system. So if I can tune how the induced magnetic field is going to affect the alkali, I can engineer a situation in which no matter what is the magnetic noise, as long as it doesn't make me exit the linear regime, i.e. I have a huge magnetic field on the outside, like let's say Earth's magnetic field, I have some huge noise. As long as it's small enough, the corrections will always be zero to leading order in the magnetic field. And this is very, very nice because it means that I am not sensitive to the magnetic noise. Now let's see what happens if I have an anomalous field which only couples to electrons. In that case, I have some BE, and the alkali is going to rotate a bit. The helium is also going to rotate because the alkali rotated. But in the end, you get some sensitivity, which gives you some measurable signal, which is exactly what we want. This will not be canceled like the magnetic noise, because the helium atom does not feel this field directly. So this guy is only going to cancel the magnetic noise. What's more interesting is the coupling axions that couple only to neutrons. In that case, the helium atom is going to be tilting, while the alkali is not feeling anything because it doesn't have, or it has a very small neutron magnetic moment. And if you carry out the math, which I'm not able to do due to time, I wasn't planning to do it because it's not that easy, but what you get is not only a measurable signal, but in fact, you get an enhancement that is related to the ratio of these two gyromagnetic ratios. So it's roughly 1,000 times more sensitive than what you would naively expect, which is why a co-magnetometer such as this is a very good device to measure neutron anomalous fields, while it works also for electrons. So it's optimized for neutrons, but it can also do electrons. So due to lack of time, I'm not gonna focus on many on some of the experiments, but basically what I was saying until now was, I remind you, we have dark matter in the form of axions that generate some magnetic light field effect. And by tuning my controlled magnetic field in something I call a co-magnetometer, I can generate a device that instead of having two independent measurements, it gives me a single measurement that is very, very sensitive to anomalous fields while remaining immune to magnetic noise. So there are two types of experiments you can do with the co-magnetometer. The first one, which
I have a question. I'm not sure I understood how this constellation happened. So that it's important to be near resonance for this constellation so that the external magnetic field is canceled by helium.
So the resonance is not really important from the compensation point. It is important for the from the point of view of what you can measure, because you can only measure masses that your system can react fast enough to. What is important is the mixing. This compensation point is generated by the mixing of these two states, and the resonance is also generated by that. But these are two different effects that are not really the same thing. The compensation happens when you tune your response to the outside magnetic field, while the resonance happens when you tune your system, your inherent system, sort of to react for each of these two independent particles to react to each other as strong as you can, basically. Mm-hmm. So these are sort of two different things. They are both controlled by my applied magnetic field, so I cannot. They are not independent, sort of.
Are there any conditions on the like time correlations or rate of change of this magnetic noise? Because I imagine if it changes too fast, probably the system cannot yes. react.
Yes.
So what is the assumption here?
I wouldn't say there's an assumption, but there. I mean, when we carry out the full math, there you can see that basically we have some. I forget the word for it, but basically a response function for different types of noise, basically depending on the frequency of the noise. And you can see how that is going to enter your signal depending on which signal you're looking for. And it is true, it is if you're looking for fast oscillating magnetic field, the compensation point does not cancel them well enough, and it doesn't work. And we take that into account in our computations. This is sort of taking a constant magnetic field in this description, and the faster the magnetic field changes, the weaker the effect of the compensation point is.
Mm-hmm. What is known about this rate of change? I mean, experimentally now.
I can, so wait a few slides and then I will tell you.
Okay, good. Thank you.
I'm going to show it. So, sorry. Oh, I'm going in the wrong direction. Sorry. Right. So, like I said, I'm going to be focusing on direct detection. You can also do long-range spin, long-range interaction searches, but I'm not going to be discussing that. And basically, dark matter direct detection works very simply. You have your co-magnetometer, you enter the compensation point, and no matter what you are doing, if axions exist, they are going to be basically penetrating your magnetic shielding, and you're going to be measuring them. This is exactly how we were able to do our first bounds in this paper, because people have measured other things using a co-magnetometer, but if axions existed, they would have appeared as some noise in some frequency that is the mass of the axion, and they would not have been able to get rid of that noise. So by using their noise spectrum, okay, which I think is like two slides or something, we are able to basically measure this new effect no matter what else you are doing with your co-magnetometer. And fifth force, I'm not going to be discussing. So I should give credit, because these people, all from the lab of Michael Ramiz from Princeton, Giorgio Vasilakis, Justin M. Brown, and Thomas W. Cornack, we were using their data, and Ramiz himself has helped our lab a lot. He came to Israel, and he basically told us of some pitfalls that you can you might do on accident, and we were able to avoid many mistakes by using his experience. So that was very nice of him. So I should give a lot of credit to them, because they sort of started this thing and they helped us a lot. And what you're seeing here is the co-magnetometer in the natural habitat. Here is magnetic shielding. Here is some coils. Here are the many optical components you have. And indeed, this is exactly what you were asking about. This is basically what we know about magnetic noise. What you're seeing here is the noise spectrum of the device. And the three data sets, okay, one of them is split into two different measurements that of these people that have taken their data, that have taken data. And basically, this is sort of what we know. This is the effective magnetic field. It's measured in units per square root of bandwidth, okay, per square root of hertz. But this is the sort of the magnetic noise that they measure. And as you can see, different devices have different capabilities, different frequencies, have different sensitivity to magnetic noise and so on. Sorry, different magnetic noises and so on. And there's also here, this is new data that we've taken. And I actually have another data that is not blinded, but this one is blinded. So I cannot look into it yet until I do some initial analysis that we took in our own lab. That's gonna sort of go to higher energies than what they were doing here. So I'm not gonna be discussing low masses and I'm not gonna be discussing this. These are the results. So in blue here, you see what the new bounds that we were able to get using their data. As you can see, for electrons, this device is not optimized for. So that's why we are able to sort of get better bounds than the next best thing. But we still don't get anywhere near the astrophysics. Things are more interesting when you look at the interaction, when you look for interactions with neutrons. Because the device is optimized to look for neutrons, as you can see, we've literally, you know, no new experiment. We're just using old data from 10 years ago. We were able to get bounds that are almost the best bounds that exist. I would say that, you know, this sort of the difference between this point and that point is probably smaller than the accuracy of this neutron star, but this is a bit more subjective, I would say. And it's, you know, I do have an interest to say that because then we would be the strongest bound. But I think this is a very strong statement that by using data that already exists without any optimization to look for dark matter specifically, we were able to get the best terrestrial bounds. We are several, many orders of magnitude stronger than the next experiment, which is Kaspar-Zolf and also Kaspar-Kammag, as well as the new N/AG. Giving us a very, very strong bound, I think, which is very, very nice, thanks to this.
Can I ask you, what happens at low, why doesn't your constraint decouple at low frequencies?
So that was one of the slides I skipped. The reason is that we have daily modulations. Because Earth rotates, basically, even if the axion is arbitrarily small mass and it doesn't rotate on its own, if we say it points in that direction and my device itself rotates, I'm going to be measuring effectively that the axion does rotate. So this is why you get basically that by measuring the signal at 1/1 day, you are still sensitive to axions with as low as mass as you want. The reason why you get these features here are not physical. It's related basically to the type of data that we had. We have better data for something that would have remained constant throughout the experiment. But basically, beyond the point where the frequency of the axion is 1/1 day, you can still measure things by measuring what happens at the daily modulation frequency.
Yeah, but the thing that confuses me about that is the following. So let's imagine that you have something that has very low frequency and you're stuck close to a zero of the signal. So let's say the cosine is zero, right?
Then
daily modulation should decouple because it averages over that. It doesn't change mass over the day. You should still get suppression that goes like
the period. So this is a statistical effect that we do take into account. The probability that you are stuck really near the zero of the cosine, right? Because you could be anywhere in that cosine, and we treat that as a random variable, and we get the 90% confidence level using that. I mean, by taking into account the fact that we could have this number as small as you want, but it is a random phase, right? It is a random initial phase. And this is the 90% confidence level, assuming it is
The bound should be placed with a worst case scenario in mind. This is confusing because the effect should still decouple at low frequencies, because if the period doesn't change, there won't be any daily modulation at all.
But it's a statistical statement, right? I mean, the probability that we are literally at the exact zero of that oscillation is zero, right? There is some probability that we are at 0.1 phase. There is some probability that we are at the peak, right? And we assume that it is a random variable. And you could say that, you know, we only have one Earth, and in the end, if it is small, then we won't know for a few millions of years. But it could just be, it could just as well be big, right? I mean, it is a random variable. And I agree. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it's sort of like saying that, a lot of things in cosmology, right? Where you have a single measurement of the universe and you assume that things were sort of random, right? I mean, you assume that the random variable would not be something special.
But that's what cosmic variance is for, right? They make that an error.
Right, yeah. And we took that into account statistically. I mean, we assume that there is some, that it is a specifically we assume that there's a uniform distribution for each possible phase, and we only measure a single one. And I think that gives you like a factor of 5 suppression to the bound. I might be wrong here. I might be remembering it wrong. But I think that's the answer.
But the way you get a modulation is the fact that you have you're using the daily modulation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, theoretically, we could be stuck at literally the zero of that oscillation. But to be completely honest, I would also not think that axions are that valid at this low a mass. They are probably not exactly, right? I mean, they should be bigger than something like 10 to the minus 22 EV, right? For them to be dark matter. Otherwise, you have some...
Yeah, there is Lyman alpha constraints.
Yeah. Which are, I mean, they don't relate to neutron interaction, which is why we don't have them here, but they are physically probably not going to be there. I mean, they should be there theoretically because
it's... They should be there because it's purely gravitational. The other thing is,
we're looking specifically at interaction with neutron, but I agree. Like morally, they are there. We're not putting it because we're here putting here only interactions with neutrons, but morally, like, no one thinks that axions are over here. I think that would be the accurate statement. So, yeah, because I'm out of time, I'm not going to be discussing all the experiments. These two are not likely to occur. One of them, because we hope that Romali's group is actually doing it on their own, but just basically doing a dedicated common atomic search instead of using some data that they already measured by accident, you know, for something else. But what we are likely to do, and like I said, I've already done 2 experiments and 2 more will be done soon, are sort of common atomic adjacent searches. So I won't be discussing fifth force, and I won't be discussing the dedicated dark matter search, despite the fact that it's a very interesting prospect. But what I will be discussing is the 4 experiments. So one, first of all, is the high-frequency Common Magnetometer. The reason why I put Common Magnetometer in brackets is because, I said earlier, basically, at high frequencies, you don't really get the compensation point. Okay, the reaction of the system is not fast enough, as Sergey asked earlier, it's not fast enough, so you don't really get all the advantages of a common magnetometer, but you can still get a measurement, and it can be quite good because there's also a lot less noise compared to the low frequency. So you are able to get some measurements, and I have it right here. As soon as I am able to analyze, we will publish these results. There's also a co-magnetometer, which it is in a proof of concept stage. Even that is a bit misleading because we are not yet showing the capability of particle physics. We are showing just the capability of such a device. It could be very interesting because you would be able to not only measure interaction with neutrons, but you would be also able to measure interaction with protons and tell the difference between the two, because xenon has 2 types of isotopes that have different nuclear spin. And we might be able to really tell the difference between the 2 isotopes and how they couple to axion. So this is something that is sort of a very early stage. I already have the data from the proof of concept stage. And hopefully once we see how things look like, we would be able to see whether it's practical to have a full experiment at some point. I doubt it, but it might be interesting. The 2 experiments that Gil Ronen, who I mentioned earlier, is leading are the rubidium xenon mid-frequency Common Magnetometry, as well as the rubidium xenon low-frequency Common Magnetometry. So the mid-frequency is something that we're going to be starting taking measurements next week, probably. It's going to take a few months, and then we would be able to look into it. Very briefly, what we look at is the interaction of axions with xenon atoms, and the reason why I'm putting here brackets in the common magnetometry is that we're not really doing this abstraction at all at this point. we are sort of using other effects from the convergentometer, but not really the compensation point, which is why, as you will see, we are only able to get some improvement compared to what you might to what you would get from a full convergentometer. And the other thing is the low frequency convergentometry, where what we do is we basically measure the two independent frequencies, sorry, the two independent couplings to electrons and to xenon atoms, and then we do the subtraction on our own, which is, like I said, less good than if the device is able to do it, but it is able to, but we can do it in a new, very interesting way that people care about, not only for particle physics. And the, like I said, these three experiments will also give us bounds for axion-proton interaction, because for helium, the two protons are presumably pointing in opposite directions, so you cannot do that. So for electrons, it's less interesting, and I don't have time. But for neutrons, these are our projection, these dashed lines. And I can actually update them to these orange lines. Actually, a new measurement tells me that it's probably going to be somewhere around here and not all the way over here. And as you can see, once we start to run our own experiment, we are going to be able to still reach significantly better results compared to the other terrestrial experiments. We are going to be able to probe higher masses and the interaction of protons that was not able to be probed until now. We are doing these experiments sort of, this is our first experiment with the system, and therefore the bounds are going to be probably not as good as Romalis, which had a lot of time to work on this, but we hope in the future to really get to this purple line. Our biggest problem right now is actually personnel. We have finite personnel and finite systems. It's a very small lab. We have two tables. So, and this lab does not exist to look for particle physics. So we are only able to use the devices some of the time, but we do hope that in the future, we are going to be able to reach here, which is, as you can see, better than the strongest astrophysical bound. And hopefully the new data is also going to be stronger than any terrestrial other existing. Yes, I hear there's a question. No? Okay. So this is what we expect to see in the near few months, these two somewhere around in this orange shaded region. Might be a bit better. I doubt it's going to be worse because I already have some initial measurements, but it might actually be better by using some smart things that we think about doing. And I think the future in the next few years, if we can find the time to do this experiment, or if Romalis finds the time to do it, it's going to be very, very interesting and very, very nice. And it's, I think, very nice. So to conclude, convergentometers offer a very strong probe to the axion-like particles parameter space. Future experiments could supersede the best existing bounds, at least the terrestrial ones, and hopefully also the astrophysical one. And this is something I like to say in case we have some new Einstein here. But basically, we don't know of any way to significantly improve the convergentometers, but if anyone has an idea that could improve by roughly six orders of magnitude, which sounds like a lot, but it's a lot better, I think, than other different experiments, you can use this to also measure asymmetric cosmic neutrinos. So, you know, that's a direct ticket to Stockholm if you have that idea. But right now we have no idea whether that's possible. We don't have any idea on how to do that. Yeah. But if anyone has a smart idea on how to make these like six orders of magnitude more sensitive, you can measure cosmic neutrinos, and you can measure actually their properties, whether they're symmetric or asymmetric, yeah, or to be more precise, measure asymmetric one.
Yeah, that's a tiny number you're talking about.
I agree. That's why I make sure to write if unexpected improvements. We don't have any idea on how to do that sort of improvement, but if we have some Einstein who can think of this idea, it would be nice to know that, you know, he had the chance to think about this. So the axion-like particles in these masses are very interesting because people like to think about fuzzy dark matter. And there are actually also papers, and I'm citing here one of them, that are saying that maybe the QCD line that we usually, you know, have some width for it, but should not be thought of that stringently, I think that's a word. And with some modeling, you might have a QCD axion, usually it's some clockwork model that has a much bigger coupling that you would naively expect. So this could be very interesting. Thank you very much for listening. This is, by the way, the Fixion from XKCD, which solved both the strong CP problem as well as the dark matter, all of these guys together. I like to finish talking.
Thank you.
Thank you. I ran a bit late.
That's cool. Like, is then you're going to?
I'm going to what?
Oh, questions.
Oh, question. Oh. I think you have a questions. Anyway, I think we asked a lot of questions.
Yeah. All right.
So, I have a question like about your compensation point. Like, is there like a measurement you can do like to show like your system is at the compensation point?
Yes. So the way to do this is actually pretty simple. So what happens is the reason why the compensation works is sort of the reaction of the nuclear changes the nuclear spin changes when you tune the outside magnetic field. And what you do is you apply a small oscillating, a very slowly oscillating magnetic field that you can control. And what you see is that once you reach the right magnetic field, suddenly you have no sensitivity to it. Basically, it's it goes linearly until it goes back to zero. And actually, in fact, because no matter how strongly we try, we always have some residual constant magnetic field. Usually, what really happens is when we get to the compensation point, suddenly the signal jumps because instead of reacting to the very constant magnetic noise that we have, you suddenly immediately cancel it using the helium atoms. So that's usually sort of the first sign that you're there. And then all you really need to do is apply a magnetic field and really check that your response is what you think it is. And because we have magnetic coils, we can really measure, and everything there is linear, we can really make sure that what we're measuring, and the sensitivity that we think we have is what we have, and the suppression that we think we have is what we have, and so on.
Yeah. So how fast does your system like drift away from that point? Or like it can stay for a very long time?
So it sort of depends on the exact system. We have several different systems in our lab, but usually it can stay for roughly, I think, a week or two before you need to make sure that things did not change. But usually, because these are very sensitive measurements, we like to make sure more often than that, you know, because you don't want to wait until you went outside of it. But even if you wait a week or two, it's still going to be in the compensation point, but it's just going to be a bit tilted. I mean, it's still going to be very near it, but it's not going to be at the exact point. Usually we like to, every once in a while, give the system a bit of a push to see how it reacts, and therefore we can check where we are. Right. But yeah, but this is a long time scale.
Thank you. Other questions?
No. Okay, so if there are no more questions, let's thank again the speaker.
Thank you for inviting me again.
I'm too stuck.